Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome to the University this afternoon. My name's Ian Harper and it's my pleasure to chair this afternoon's session on China and the new economy. I would like to acknowledge, to begin with, the alumni of the University. It's wonderful to have you back here at the University this afternoon and supporting the University's Festival of Ideas. I also acknowledge our distinguished guests, amongst whom I see former Vice-Chancellor Professor David Pennington. David, lovely to see you again here this afternoon. Ladies and gentlemen, if you've been to former sessions, you'll be aware of the routine. If this is your first, then can I point out that these sessions are being filmed and also taped, audio tape. So please be aware of that. When it comes to question and answer time, I'll be asking that you keep your questions brief, but also that you speak up so that your question can be appropriately heard on the audio tape. It's also time now to turn off your mobile phones. So can I ask you please to do that if you've not already done that at this point. Please turn off your mobile phones. Well, China and the new economic order. What could be more apposite a topic than that? And we have for you this afternoon three experts, one political scientist, and two economists to enlighten us about China and the new economic order this afternoon. On my immediate right is Dr. Pradeep Taneja. Pradeep is with the University's School of Politics, or I should say Social and Political Sciences. Pradeep is a political scientist by training. He's also someone who has a deep interest in China and a lot of experience. He's lived in China for many years, and so I understand he's fluent in Mandarin, Pradeep, although I have it on good authority that he's going to speak to us in English this afternoon. On Pradeep's right is Saul Eslake. Saul would be well known to this audience, particularly in this city. Saul is chief economist of ANZ Bank, and you would be aware that amongst our major banks, the ANZ arguably has the greatest exposure and interest in Asia. Saul is regularly in China, has a significant interest in the Chinese economy, and in particular, today he'll be talking to us about China and the world economy, how China has been dealing with the GFC and what it might mean for all of us as China responds to the GFC. And then on Saul's right is Associate Professor Mark Crosby. Mark and I have been colleagues for many years when I was until recently at the Melbourne Business School. Mark is still at the Melbourne Business School, and Mark is a macroeconomist like myself, but unlike myself, Mark has a special interest in Asia and China. Mark has spent a number of years in different institutions around Asia, most notably the Hong Kong Monetary Authority, and some time also at the National Monetary Authority of Singapore. So Mark is well informed about China. Today he's going to talk to us about China and Australia, the economic relationship between those two countries, again, which won't surprise you to hear, is very important for us. I'm going to invite our speakers to speak in order, one after the other, and I've asked each to speak to us for 10 minutes, which is a little less time than perhaps others have been used to in the series here at the festival, but I've asked each of them to speak for 10 minutes only so that we have maximum time for interaction with the audience. So do please prepare your questions as you are listening to our speakers. It's my pleasure now to introduce Dr. Pradeep Taneja. Pradeep is going to speak to us to begin with about the growing interrelationship between the business and political elites in modern China. Please welcome Dr. Pradeep Taneja.
Well, we've had some fascinating discussions about China yesterday evening and again this morning, and I hope that you haven't yet exhausted your curiosity about China, and there's still plenty of ideas left and plenty of questions left to ask, and we'll try and answer those questions as well as we can. As Ian said, I have an interest in the relationship between politics and business in China. As somebody teaching in a school of political science, I have an interest in not only just the pure politics of China, but also the economic factors behind that politics. Now, in the past few months, if you've been reading the newspapers in this country, a great deal of newspaper column space has been devoted to the efforts of a state-owned Chinese company to increase its stake in one of Australia's largest mining companies. Naturally, a range of views have been expressed on the merits or otherwise of this proposal, with some for and others against it. Along with some very incisive commentary, we've also seen and heard a lot of emotional arguments, including a television advertisement, which was obviously against this proposal. But what has been missing from this debate is any objective discussion of the relationship between what is happening in China itself and China's ambitions for its role in the rest of the world. So let me briefly look at China or developments in China, and then I'll try and look at China's role or China's desired role in the world. When one looks at China's economic reforms of the past 30 years, it becomes apparent that despite all the economic dynamism of China, the role of the state in the country's economic life has not declined to any significant extent. True, it can no longer be called a centrally planned command economy, but that does not mean that the Chinese state has retreated from managing the economy. Its methods have changed, but not the desire to control the commanding heights of the economy. Now, if you go back and look at the reforms, early reforms of the 1980s, you see a number of features of that particular phase in China's economic development. And quite often, China's reforms are described using Deng Xiaoping's phrase that we cross the river while feeling for the stones under feet, Mo Che Shi Tou Guo He. But we've seen that in the 80s, these reforms were experimental. In other words, there was no blueprint to follow. And the Communist Party leadership and the Chinese people were experimenting with what was feasible and what was not. In other words, two steps forward, perhaps one step backward. And also, another feature of these early reforms was that the focus of the early reforms in the early 1980s, and to some extent even in the second half of the 1980s, that the focus was very much on rural China. And more importantly, these first phase of reforms were accompanied by a more liberal political outlook. It did not mean that China was democratic in the 1980s, but there was much greater tolerance of different views, even encouragement for different views until the events of May-June 1989. But since the events of June 4th, 1989, China has moved into a new phase of economic development. The policy changes beginning in the 1990s, to use Huang Yasheng's words, Huang Yasheng is a leading China scholar who's now based at MIT, and he says that the 1990s reforms were not experimental. In other words, unlike the 1980s reforms, the 1990s reforms were not experimental. Rather, they were rooted in a technocratic industrial policy blueprint and a heavy urban bias. So apart from the technocratic nature and urban bias, the economic policies that began to take shape in the early 1990s were designed not with an aim to foster private entrepreneurship, but to entrench state control over the economy and to promote political dependency on the state. What has emerged over the past two decades is a system in which the politics and business have become conflated. What Charles Young describes in his posthumously published memoirs as the commercialization of power. This naturally leads to corruption. This form or this close relationship between politics and business naturally leads to corruption and abuse of power, which in turn leads to public anger and loss of faith in the government, which we see in the increasing incidence of the so-called mass incidents or popular protests in China. If you look at the large state-owned sector of the economy, the party control over this sector is still quite strong. While the state has retreated from some sectors of the economy, its policy of grasping the large, letting go of the small, means that it continues to maintain a firm grip on a number of important industrial sectors, despite many institutional changes over the past 30 years. Party supervision in industry is exercised mainly through appointment, performance appraisal, and quote-unquote discipline inspection of company cadres. It is not uncommon in China today for officials to move between corporate and bureaucratic positions at the behest of the party leadership. We saw, for example, the person who inked the deal with, the initial deal with Rio Tinto is now an employee of the State Council or the Chinese cabinet. So the chairman of a major mining company can become a government bureaucrat. The party's right to appoint, transfer, or sack senior corporate executives of state-owned enterprises means that it is able to control their corporate and political behavior to a large extent. Now, what of the private entrepreneurs? While the government does not seek to privatize the whole economy, its control over the economy and its ability to change policy without much debate or no debate at all means that it makes sense for the entrepreneurs to get as close to the party and the government as possible. Ever since the changes to the party constitution early this decade, it is now possible to be bourgeois and communist at the same time. For many new millionaire members of the party, the motivation for joining the party is not ideological sympathy with the party doctrine, that is, assuming that there is a party doctrine now. Rather, it is to get access to the policy and material resources that the party still controls. In addition to joining the party, many entrepreneurs are also actively seeking membership of the People's Congresses at the local, provincial, or national levels. Alternatively, they seek to become members of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, or CPPCC, which is a consultative body which meets in parallel with the People's Congress but lacks its legislative powers. So, why does the party want entrepreneurs to join the party? I mean, in other words, why does it encourage the new capitalists to become members of the Chinese Communist Party? The answer has to be co-option. In other words, the party is keen to co-opt all social forces that could challenge the party's authority. It knows, that is, the Communist Party knows, that an independently wealthy class can be a threat to party rule. And of course, there are a number of reasons, and we don't have time to go into all the reasons for it, but clearly, the newly wealthy entrepreneurial class, or the middle class, although some of my colleagues disagree that China has a new middle class, but if you look at this particular class, whether it's entrepreneurial or new middle class, it is interested in protecting its private property from arbitrary seizure. Now, we know that the Communist Party is not going out and seizing private property, but given the nature of the authoritarian political system, the possibility of that happening in the future cannot be discounted 100%. And that's why the new entrepreneurs or the new middle classes would like to see some guarantee for security of their private property. Secondly, as entrepreneurs, they also want to see greater transparency in policy making. Let me now turn to China's international role. Earlier this morning, Professor Wang Kunggu argued that China has, having gone through a debate, China is now in favor of a status quo in the international system. I unfortunately find myself not agreeing with Professor Wang Kunggu on this particular point, because I think China is neither a status quo nor a revisionist power. Its position on different parts of the international system depends on how each part affects its own interests and objectives. So, for example, on the reform of international financial institutions, it advocates significant changes to enhance its own position within those institutions. On the other hand, when it comes to the reform of the United Nations Security Council or the non-proliferation regime, it is generally in favor of maintaining the status quo. So, for example, China today is the only Asian power to be a permanent member of the Security Council. And there are other particularly Japan and India, who would like to get a seat as permanent members of the Security Council, and China is unwilling to concede to the reform of the Security Council if it means that any of those two powers is going to share that status with China. If you look at foreign aid and investment, China, if you've been following the media reports, China has become a significant donor of development assistance. When it comes to foreign aid and investment, China seeks to promote its economic interests by linking investment and aid. In the process, it undermines the fledgling foreign aid regime that has been evolving under pressure from civil society groups in traditional donor countries. We know that traditional donor countries have not always been clean in the sense that they have also used foreign aid for economic purposes. But over the past 20 years, under pressure from civil society, a regime seems to be emerging. Although it is not in the same nature as, for example, the international financial regime, but a regime seems to be emerging where a decoupling of investment and aid has been emphasized. But China's foreign aid and investment policies tend to undermine that fledgling regime. Finally, we live in a world which is complexly interdependent. While China seeks to change some parts of the international economic order, it wants to maintain some other elements of the international system. The arrival of China on the world stage as a major economic power will change the world, but China itself will change in the process. It cannot remain unaffected by what happens in the rest of the world. The big question is whether political change in China will be affected by the Communist Party or it will be forced upon it. Thank you.
Thank you and good afternoon. Not only, as Professor Harper said in introducing me, do I work for an organisation that has a significant commercial presence in Asia in general and China in particular, but at the personal level, my wife and I have two children adopted from China, so at both levels take a particular interest in what's happening in that country. And of course, over the last 30 years, China's economic achievements have been truly astonishing. As I'm sure everyone's aware, more people have been lifted out of poverty more quickly over that time than at any other in human history. China is now rightly regarded as a major participant in the global economy and is quite legitimately seeking a role commensurate with that in forms of international governance, not least in terms of economic and financial governance. Yet, over the past decade, I'd argue that two aspects in particular of China's economic growth and transformation have become increasingly problematic. First, its double-digit growth over the years 2003 through 2007, peaking in mid-2007 at a rate of 14%, were unstable, imbalanced, uncoordinated, and unsustainable. Who said that? Not me, but Premier Wen Jiabao, speaking in 16th of March 2007 to the State Council. And he was right. China had become characterised during this period by a number of bubbles, particularly in its property and stock markets, which were in turn fuelled by the monetary policy settings that China was forced to follow as a result of the combination of large and growing current account surpluses and an unwillingness to countenance either offsetting private capital outflows or an appreciation of its currency against those of its principal trading partners. And as a result, within China itself, there were distortions and bubbles that in their own way were as potentially damaging for the Chinese economy as the bubbles which had grown up within the United States and British economies in their respective property and stock markets. The second aspect of this is that China had unintentionally, I'll grant you, contributed to the growing instability in the global economy. Its massive external surpluses were in their own way, as much a part of the instability in the global economy, the consequences of which we've witnessed over the last 18 months, as the corresponding large deficits being run by the United States and other countries. China contributed directly to the excessively easy global financial market environment, which, along with inappropriately loose monetary policies in the United States far beyond the justification for them, contributed to the emergence of the asset price bubble in the United States, of which the subprime mortgage market was a part. And there's no better direct evidence for that than the fact that the Chinese central bank itself had, by the middle of last year, accumulated nearly $400 billion in bonds issued by the two US mortgage insurance agencies, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. And China has, through that, contributed to a major policy problem for itself, namely that it now has some $2 trillion US dollars worth of foreign exchange reserves, which are overwhelmingly denominated in US dollars, and is thus, perhaps more than any other single agency in the world, vulnerable to the possibility of a significant fall in the US dollar. Yet China itself, in worrying about that risk and in contemplating actions supposedly designed to minimize that risk to itself, is in grave danger of precipitating what it fears, that is, a run on the US dollar if it were now to take the kind of action to protect itself against that risk by reducing its holdings of US dollars. Moreover, the bursting of China's own property and share market bubbles in the first half of last year, that is, before the onset of the most severe phase of the global financial crisis, has had more to do with the subsequent slowing of the Chinese economy than has the decline in China's exports that really only began in November last year after the collapse of Lehman Brothers. That said, so far China has had what could be called a good crisis in four respects. First, it has made what are uniformly regarded as bold policy responses to the downturn in its own economy. There are a few other countries which have gone as far as China has in terms of marshalling fiscal policy in particular in order to address the economic downturn within its own borders. Secondly, it's evident in China to a much greater extent than in any other major economy that the measures it's taken, both fiscal and monetary policy, to put a floor under the downturn in its economy have been effective. There are few economies in the world that can make a reasonable claim that their economies will be growing at something like their sustainable trend pace before the year is out than China. Third, China has emerged as playing a constructive role in international coordination of global responses to the crisis. For example, by eschewing, for the most part, protectionist measures, although in that context I note with some concern the announcement over the last few days of what appear to be significant preferences for domestic firms in government procurement, which of course just understands the futility of some of our own state governments seeking to do the same thing. I include under that heading of playing a constructive role in international negotiations about the crisis the proposals that have been put forward earlier this year by the Governor of the People's Bank of China, Governor Zhou, for a new system of international reserve management. That's not to say that I endorse the particular specifics of China's proposal to use the SDR, the IMF's special drawing right, as a new international currency, or for the IMF all of a sudden to become some kind of global bank issuing that currency, but rather the fact that China has been prepared to come forward with well thought out proposals as a contribution to what is undoubtedly an important medium term global issue reflect well on the way the authorities in China have responded to that. And finally, and perhaps again not necessarily intentionally, China has been a major indirect beneficiary of the damage that the global financial crisis has done to the international reputation of the so-called Washington Consensus, the idea that, for the most part, market forces unfettered to any significant degree by government regulation, should be the major driver of and determinant of patterns of economic growth in individual countries and around the world. Instead, China's, if it can be called Beijing consensus, of essentially state-directed economic growth, with state-owned enterprises playing a major role in key industries and with government continuing to exercise tight control over financial sector activities in particular, at the moment, does appear to many elsewhere in the world as being a more desirable outcome. Now, I don't necessarily endorse that conclusion myself, and I'm not advocating it. What I'm simply saying is that as a result of the collateral damage that the US model of economic activity, or the Anglo-Saxon model of economic governance, has sustained, China's standing with the rest of the world has been commensurately enhanced. Yet China cannot, in my view, seek to return to the status quo ante in the international economic order, that is, simply to restore the world to where it was before the onset of the financial crisis. The rest of the world, and in particular the United States, won't long tolerate what they see as, rightly or wrongly, China's mercantilist trade policy as being the primary way in which they interact with the rest of the world. The rest of the world isn't going to tolerate, and nor, I would argue, is it in China's interests for it to resume its running of what I've sometimes described as the greatest vendor financing scheme the world has ever known. That is, the arrangements whereby, in effect, prior to the onset of the crisis, China lent to Americans the money that Americans needed to keep borrowing so that they could keep buying the goods which China needed to keep exporting to them so that China could in turn sustain its model of primarily export-led growth. Just as the US saves too little and spends too much and needs to reverse that, China does the reverse, saving too much and spending too little. Much of the excess saving undertaken within the Chinese economy is not in the aggregate by households, although Chinese households do save a very high 40% of their disposable income. Household income, in turn, is actually quite a small share, not only by European or American standards, but even by the standards of other Asian nations, share of China's overall national income. Rather, the excess savings from the perspective of China's economy as a whole are, for the most part, in the corporate sector, and in particular, these days, within the state-owned enterprises sector. And it's that excess savings, which Chinese SOEs are allowed largely to keep for themselves, free of any market discipline, or indeed even any policy discipline exercised by China's economic ministries over how it's allocated, that in turn lies behind the excess investment that is another key characteristic of the Chinese economy by contrast not only with Western economies but also with most other Asian economies at similar stages of their economic development. Fortunately, and I say this from China's perspective as much as from that of any external observer, there is a neat solution to these imbalances that persist within China's economy. And that is for the Chinese government to introduce dividend requirements on its state-owned enterprises, that is, requiring them to transfer to the Chinese state as the owner of these enterprises a significant proportion of their profits, which would in turn allow the Chinese state to fund a more adequate social security system that would in turn reduce the need for Chinese households and families to save as much of their incomes as they do and allow them to spend more. At the same time, imposing a dividend requirement on China's state-owned enterprises would oblige them to submit to the discipline of either the stock market, the bond market, or a more commercially oriented banking system in allocating the capital for investment and hence inevitably resulting in slightly less of that. A likely consequence also would be that China would run smaller external surpluses and desirably would allow more of those surpluses to be offset by capital outflow, that is allowing ordinary Chinese citizens and Chinese institutions to invest in other parts of the world, an option that's currently denied to them. And all of that would, in my view, not only be in the interests of the international economy broadly defined, but would also be very much in China's own interests. And since, as a major power in its own right, the Chinese, no less than any other country of similar standing, can be expected to decide what they do primarily by reference to what's in their own interests, it's my hope that Chinese economic policy over the next 5 to 10 years is going to go down that particular path, in which case not only will the world be a more stable place economically, but Chinese people will also enjoy the better living conditions to which their own efforts very much entitle them.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Pradeep and Saul, and let me begin by just making a couple of comments. We're going to have a bit of a banter before we open up to the floor between the three of us, but I think that particularly Pradeep and the two economists have probably got similar views, but not entirely the same views, and just want to pick up on a couple of things that both Saul and Pradeep have said before I start into my main theme. Pradeep made the point that The reforms since the 1990s in particular have tended to be technocratic. That's a very interesting observation. And I guess to me, the reason that reforms have tended to be technocratic is because most of the leadership in China are engineers. In an economy which traditionally was focused on the commanding heights, things like shipbuilding and heavy industry, it makes sense to have the economy guided by people like engineers. And so historically, engineers have been very much overrepresented among the leadership in China. And that situation is still the case today. And the reform that Saul mentioned to the dividend payout requirements is an interesting example. That's a very technocratic approach to what is known to be a problem in China. And I agree with Saul, and most economists would say the same thing. It's one of the big problems in the global economy today, as in the past decade or so, has been these global imbalances. And Saul gave you one description. The other description I like is from The Economist magazine, which said it's the deal whereby China sells cheap suits to the United States in return for IOUs. Again, the level of global imbalances is a problem, and that problem is related to the high level of savings in China by Chinese households and Chinese firms. Households save a lot because health provision is poor, public health provision is poor, public education provision is poor, and therefore people have to save for that. So an engineer perhaps is less able to see these social problems than others would in the leadership. And I'm confident that as the leadership evolves in the coming years, I think some of these problems will be better addressed as we move away from a sort of more technocratic system. But that's something we might open up to in a moment. I guess that leads me to my talk. Fundamentally, I am an optimist, at least as far as the economic impacts of China's rise go. And that's where I want to get you to today. But let me start by going back to the year 1280. I think Wang Gungwu gave a fantastic presentation last night on China's relationship with the West from the long perspective, beginning with Marco Polo. So let me take you back to the time that Marco Polo went to China, at which point China was as wealthy or wealthier in terms of GDP per capita than Europe. And it's not surprising, basically all countries were poor at that time, all countries were pretty agricultural. But according to at least economists' best measured data, at that time China was as wealthy as Europe. China was a major trading centre, of course the Silk Route is well known to all of us, and during the 16th and 17th centuries China ran large trade surpluses and was called the global sink for silver at that time. So interestingly they were accumulating silver, not US Treasury bills in the 16th and 17th century, which reminds me that a few years ago Warren Buffett decided that that silver was a good thing and he was going to go back into silver about the same time that the Chinese started to really accumulate US Treasuries. And I kind of wonder if maybe the Chinese would be listening now to what Warren Buffett's advice might be, because I suspect the silver market might be a better bet than US Treasuries. In 1950, China's population was 554 million out of a global population of 2.5 billion, roughly 20% of the global population. India's population at that time was 357 million. The 20% of the global population living in China enjoyed only about 4% of global GDP at that time. So it was a very bad century and a half from 1820 to 1950 for China. Between 1950 and 1979, things didn't really get much better on the economic front. An emphasis initially under Mao Zedong's rule of growing the population led to China's population increasing from 550 to 970 million people by 1979. That 970 million people represented nearly 25% of the global population. It increased its population share. But that 25% of the global population enjoyed still only 4 to 5% of global GDP. In 1979, Australia's GDP was about two-thirds the size of China's GDP, and yet China had 50 times our population. So China was indeed a very poor country. 1979 was a pivotal year for China when these things started to change. In 1979, there were two major reforms. There was the one-child policy and the beginning of economic reforms. As Pradeep said, economic reforms were very slow, often very painful, but I think they've worked, and I think most economists would say that they've worked, compared particularly with the big bang, the quick economic reforms in the Eastern European countries and Russia. These reforms have worked very well in terms of raising living standards in China. In 1979, China's share of global trade was only 1% of global trade, and that was basically trade in oil and in sugar and things like that with the rest of the communist bloc. The market economy, to the extent that it existed in 1979, was about 20% of the economy. 80% of the population, or nearly 800 million people, lived in the countryside, yet agriculture produced only 28% of GDP, and the population were at constant risk of famine. Now, as Pradeep said, China's approach to reform under Deng Xiaoping was very slow but very pragmatic. And I want to give you an example of the reforms, and Pradeep mentioned the reforms initially were in the agricultural sector. And there's an example that's been related to me which I think illustrates very nicely how the reform process has worked in China. There's a village, a well-known story about a village in Anhui province, which is just to the west of Shanghai. The village is called Shaogang Village, where in 1978 the village leaders agreed, illegally, that they would fulfil the collective quota for agricultural produce in their village, but beyond that, individuals or households would be able to keep the excessive production that was produced in their village. There was an agreement that no one was allowed to tell anyone about this agreement, and that if anyone was found out and any village leader was jailed, the family of that village leader would be supported by the rest of the villagers. And this system, which was called the household responsibility system, of course, did get discovered. But in the fact that this system actually worked to increase output, increase agricultural produce in that village, meant that a similar system was replicated in other parts of China and led to the very large increases in agricultural output through the late 1970s and particularly early 1980s. Output in that village alone increased fourfold within a couple of years, and within 5 years of that, those types of reforms, agricultural output in China as a whole increased enough to increase farmers' incomes by 2 2/3 times. So essentially they went from a situation of famine to a situation of no famine, and indeed farmers' incomes rising in just a few short years. And ironically, as Pradeep also mentioned, the reforms initially in the agricultural sector raised hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, raised the incomes at levels of hundreds of millions of farmers. Today, the challenge is that those farmers haven't raised their income very much since that time. The great challenge for China now is to grow incomes in the rural sector and in the west of China, where income levels are still very poor, very low. I think Pradeep's already mentioned the fact that the reform process started off being very pragmatic, and that example I've just given is one example of that. In 1992, China became officially a socialist market economy, and the word market was incorporated into the constitution, became effectively a capitalist country formally. Since that time, the size of the private sector and the services sector has steadily increased. But there's still this problem of how China can properly sequence its reform, how it can maintain social harmony, and how it can grow its private sector. The growth of the private sector in China has been stymied still today, and certainly in the past, by a lack of reform in financial markets, in the foreign exchange markets, in the banks and elsewhere. Private firms are still heavily reliant on internal funds to generate, to finance investments. Private firms are unable to get funding from banks typically. Ironically, that's been advantageous, I think, to China in the last year or so. The reason they've been able to respond so quickly to the global financial crisis is that it's still quite easy for the government to direct the banks to deliver funds to state-owned enterprises and have economic activity occur with a fairly short lag, and that's not possible in most other countries. So it's been advantageous to have this system. But in the long run, a system where the banks are lending too much to state-owned enterprises and not enough to the private sector is not going to deliver you as good economic outcomes as are possible. Much of China's reforms have been accompanied by an opening up to trade, and indeed the reforms have been assisted by an opening up to trade in the sense that they've often learned from opening up to trade. Again, the reforms initially were very step-by-step. Special economic zones were created, and things were tried out in these special economic zones. There were tax concessions given and so on. These special economic zones encouraged exports. They relied heavily on cheap labour initially. But again, these special economic zones allowed experimentation in terms of what works as far as the overall economy goes. And if particular reforms and policies worked, they were tried out in a broader parts of China rather than just within the special economic zones. One point I want to make is that I don't think China's rules in terms of these special economic zones and so on were just aimed at encouraging exports. There is it's particularly in the US, this view that China is very mercantilist. It's well to remember that the rise of China has fundamentally altered global trade patterns. The US and Europe see China as somewhere that they import goods from. But the rest of Asia sees China as a great export opportunity. The patterns of global trade have shifted very dramatically in the past, particularly the past decade, and since 2001, when China acceded to the World Trade Organization. And indeed, many people in the US in particular complain that China takes manufacturing jobs from the United States. Most economists don't think that that's true. The reality is low-tech manufacturing jobs left Australia, left the United States many years ago. In the United States, with the North American Free Trade Agreement, a lot of low-tech, low-skill businesses went to Mexico. Those businesses subsequently have gone to China, but long ago they left the United States. So the real challenge in terms of the sort of challenges to global economies from the rise of China comes to countries like Thailand and Mexico, and countries that are competing at the low to medium skill end of the distribution, rather than to countries like Australia and the US, which have long been not at the forefront of low-skill manufacturing. The opening up of China to trade has not been matched by the opening up of China at all on its what's called the capital account of its balance of payments. In other words, China has encouraged foreign direct investment, foreign companies or entities to buy stakes in Chinese companies, but China has for a long time not allowed, and only recently very much restricted, other flows, what are called portfolio flows, on the balance of payments. Portfolio flows are where people buy and sell shares in China, or Chinese citizens buy and sell shares overseas. So a large part of the capital account in terms of flows of money and flows of ideas and so on in other countries doesn't exist or hasn't existed until recently in China. As with other parts of the economy, the capital account in China is being reformed. They're reforming it in a typical Chinese way. They've introduced what's called a QDII and a QFII schemes, which put a quota on the amount of money that can go into China to buy shares and the amount of money that can go out of China to buy shares. Who can do those transactions is regulated. So it's a very typical Chinese approach to reform. And as with other reforms, they're sort of tinkering with those reforms. The size of the quota is being increased steadily, and I would anticipate that what will eventually happen is that those quotas will become non-binding. Anyone will be able to move money in and out on the capital account, but it will take some years to get to that point. Of course, the reason we sort of see the rise of China in Australia is Chinalco and other acquisitions by Chinese companies. That's an example of a capital account transaction. It's well to point out that currently the stock of foreign ownership of Australian assets is 1.724 trillion Australian dollars. That's 1,724 billion Australian dollars worth of assets in Australia are owned by foreigners. That's about 1.5 times our GDP. Of that $1.7 trillion, Chinese organisations own about $8 billion currently, less than half of 1%. That doesn't count the existing Chinalco stake in Rio because that's listed in the United Kingdom. But the current Chinese levels of ownership of Australian assets are minuscule. The flip side of the $1.7 trillion of assets owned by foreigners is our roughly $1 trillion Australian dollars that we own of foreign assets as Australians through our superannuation funds and elsewhere. Incidentally, that amount has doubled since 2001. So both sides of these transactions are increasing as we're integrating, as are other countries, with the global economy. Our holdings of Chinese assets amount to about $7 billion or 0.7% of our total foreign asset holdings. So at the moment, Chinese holdings of Australian companies, and this is at the end of last year, and Australian holdings of foreign companies in China are very, very small. And it would be astonishing if these flows didn't increase and the size of these stocks didn't increase very steadily in coming years. As China opens up its capital account, it will continue to invest offshore and Australia would be seen to be a very desirable destination. China's progress in the past 30 years has been remarkable, but let me finish by speculating on where I see China in another 30 years. What's going to happen with regard to their economy and its integration with the global economy? As I mentioned, China 30 years ago had 1% of global trade. It now has about 8% of global trade. 30 years ago, it had 4% of global GDP. That's more than doubled to about 11% of global GDP. Whether China's trade share will continue to increase or not, whether we'll continue to see China growing exports, certainly we won't see it at rates of early this decade, but whether we continue to see it growing its trade share is debatable or not amongst economists. China, like the US, is a big economy, a big internal economy, so it may not need to trade right up to its population share. But it wouldn't be surprising if China's trade share in a global sense continued to rise slightly. What is almost certain is that China's share of global GDP will continue to rise. They are still a poor country. There's no reason, as far as economists are concerned, that China can't continue to grow. And so their share of global GDP should slowly move towards their population share in coming years, certainly for the next 20 or 30 years. China will be, in the coming years, much more open to inward and outward investment. We look mostly at what Chinese entities are doing in Australia, but there's a lot of restrictions on what foreign companies, including Australian companies, can do in China. But I suspect those restrictions will be relaxed. In Australia, I think we need to make our investment rules and processes more transparent in order to encourage and facilitate this where it's desirable from a national interest perspective. I think one of the things we've seen with the Chinalco issue in the past few months is that our processes in Australia are not very transparent. And that's coming from someone who very briefly worked in our Foreign Investment Review Board. Still under secrecy on that one, I think. Finally, let me just say, since this is the Festival of Ideas, and the other main theme, of course, is climate change, let me make a couple of comments on that front. I've mentioned that China's per capita income levels will continue to grow, and by my sort of forecast, they'll be at about US current per capita income levels sometime towards 2050. In the time that our institutions were built, current global institutions were built in 1950, the US and Europe were about 50% of global GDP and 30% of the global population. In 2050, the United Nations estimates that the US plus Europe will be about 11% of the global population. So their population share has declined dramatically. It would be remarkable if global institutions didn't reflect not only the sort of declining population weight of the US and Europe, but also their declining GDP weight. By my guesstimates, the US and Europe will be about a quarter of global GDP at 2050. The fact that China is going to converge towards richer country income levels in coming years means that China and other countries have to produce GDP much more efficiently energy efficiency has to improve. It's simply the case that China cannot produce greenhouse gas emissions at the rate Australia does. We produce about 5 times the amount of emissions that China does per capita. China could not do that with its population without destroying the physical environment that we live in. So the ways that China has to produce GDP will have to be much more sustainable, and I think that provides opportunities as well as challenges as far as technological progress goes in coming years. Finally, as I said, I'm optimistic on these developments. I think they're very exciting. The integration of China into the world economy has led to a much more prosperous environment, but I think it's also led to a more stable and safer global economy, and perhaps Pradeep might pick me up on that one, but hopefully global politics as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to allow each of our speakers, just very briefly, to open up our general question and answer time by making an observation of what their colleagues have said, or possibly asking a question of them, just to get us going. So, Pradeep, can I start with you? Anything that either Saul or Mark said that struck a chord with you, or that you'd like to query?
Maybe I'll first comment on Saul's point, and I totally agree with the changes. I mean, I think it's unlikely that the share of public ownership in China is going to change dramatically anytime soon. But China can take some positive steps. And the idea of having Chinese companies to actually pay dividends will make a huge difference. And one of the reasons, for example, why this whole controversy about Chinese investments in Africa, this controversy has been raging for a number of years now, and it's not only Western NGOs who are complaining about it. Within Africa also, there are people who are quite opposed to many of the Chinese investments. And the reason why Chinese companies are so successful in investing in those assets, for example, oil and gas in Africa, is because these companies can take risks that multinational oil companies cannot. Because these companies are not really very responsive to their shareholders, in other words, the Chinese public. Whereas multinational oil companies, if it was Shell or Exxon or BP, will have to be very careful about return on that investment. And I think if China makes a move in that direction, that will be quite a significant move. So I totally agree.
Thank you, Pradeep. Saul Islak.
Well, let me sort of put to Pradeep something well in his sphere of expertise. I've had the impression from visiting China a number of times since I first went there in 1994 that there is probably less demand for the kind of reforms that were being sought 20 years ago at Tiananmen and up to that point. There is less demand for those kind of reforms now than there was then, in part because many of the Chinese people who wanted those reforms then saw what happened in Eastern Europe and in particular in Russia when they got them and China didn't, and rightly or wrongly drew the conclusion that instant political freedom tended to lead to economic collapse and the loss of national prestige. And over the period since then, the Chinese Communist Party would probably say they've kept their side of a bargain, which says we'll deliver continuous rapid improvements in living standards and you let us run the place according to our lights and don't dissent too much. So my sort of question is, how far away are we from the point at which, if the history of most other countries is any guide, you get to a point where enough of the population feels that they are sufficiently materially well off, that they are actually, they start to get more interested in having a say in how they're governed, which doesn't necessarily mean that they want dramatic changes in the way that they are governed in practice, but that they just want to have it. And therefore, you know, how well is China likely to be placed to handle that kind of transition compared with India, which in a sense has got it the other way around?
Sure. Big questions, Pradeep.
Big question.
A very quick response.
And I'll try and be as brief as possible.
We can come back to those things because Saul's raised a number of issues that I'm sure we'll come back to.
I mean, Saul says that he went to China in 94 for the first time.
For the first time.
And clearly that was, you know, a few years after the Tiananmen Square. and there wasn't much of a public appetite for political change, largely because of what people had seen happen in 1989. So at that time, Deng Xiaoping in 1992 obviously decided that the response to the 1989 crisis was not to turn inwards, but to open up China even further. And hence the 1992 Southern Tour, the famous Southern Tour, when Deng Xiaoping went to southern Chinese provinces and urged the Chinese leaders in those provinces to open up the economy further. So contrary to what many foreign experts believe, that China will actually now turn inwards, Deng Xiaoping's response was quite the opposite. He said, we need to open up. But at the same time, we need to hold the grip on political power even more tightly. And as a result of that social compact between the Chinese government and the Chinese people, the government, by focusing on economic growth, by opening up the economy, guaranteed that it will continue to improve the living standards of the Chinese public. In return, it asked for patience. It asked for loyalty and patience on the political reform front. But the problem now is that since it's been 20 years now since Tiananmen Square, and when it comes to political reform, if we use Deng Xiaoping's old saying about crossing the river feeling for the stones, on the economic front, I think China is halfway in the middle of the river now, right? While still feeling for the stones. But on the political reform side, I think they have not even taken the first major step. There have been institutional changes. In other words, we've seen institutionalization of politics. Professor Wang Kong-woo yesterday referred to succession, for example. Now, unlike during Mao's time, succession from one leader to another in China is now fairly well organized and well orchestrated. Mm. For example, we already know who the next leader of the Chinese Communist Party would be. We know who the next prime minister would be, unless, of course, there's a major political crisis in China. So that social compact is now being tested in the wake of this global financial crisis. Because that magic number of 8% that Professor Wang mentioned yesterday and Chinese media keep repeating, it is now, there's no guarantee, for example, that this year China will grow at 9%. The World Bank this morning is saying 7.2%. Others, some say higher than 8, some say less than 7. But there is I think, slight consternation within the Communist Party leadership that what happens if we cannot return to the days of 9% plus growth? Because already there are a lot of people, and I mentioned earlier, and Mark confirmed that in the Chinese countryside, there is already a great deal of concern about a very slow and in many cases negative sort of return when it comes to individual incomes. Huang Yasheng, I quoted Huang Yasheng earlier in his book, Capitalism with Chinese Characteristics, he actually says that household incomes have declined in many parts of China rather than increased. So overall, China's GDP may have risen, but on many fronts, the ordinary Chinese people are feeling the pinch. And this is going to be a real test for China, whether they can actually maintain those continuous improvements in living standards. If they can't, then I think the day when political reform and the pressure for political reform will mount.
Will come indeed. Mark, any comment from yourself?
Yeah, again, the one thing I mentioned earlier is just this issue about the sort of technocratic approach to development and so on, which I follow in the sense that I think it is technocratic, but I still think it's pragmatic. At least, and again, you're right, as far as the economy goes, I think you've agreed it clearly is, and I agree with you, they're about halfway across that river. And there are plenty of recent examples that we can point to where reforms have been tried and then reversed, other reforms have been tried. I suspect this dividend payout ratio one will be one of those ones that may be very quickly reversed. It doesn't sound very sensible. But even on the political front, it seems to me that they have at least taken steps, and they are pragmatic even on that front, in the sense that we're observing protests. Professor Wang last night was asked the question about the internal, not dissent, but I guess questioning about how Tibetans were treated on the internet and so on, with a prominent group of dissidents. Those sorts of things didn't happen 20 and 30 years ago, for sure. and increasingly we're seeing protests and so on. So it does seem to me that, as Professor Wang said last night, we're not going to see democracy anytime soon, and who knows when, if ever. But we are seeing experimentation even and pragmatism even on the on that political front within the bounds of maintaining social harmony and maintaining the sort of one-party state, basically. Mm. The other point that I guess I'd like to raise with Pradeep is probably one a little bit off topic, but one that he brought up was this issue of China's aid and investment. And I guess I tend to disagree that aid currently is untied. I think what we're observing is still aid that is tied, but it's tied to multilateral agendas, not to country-specific agendas. So we've seen in the past that international aid from the US has been very much tied to US investment or US political ambitions. We're seeing now the aid to the to Africa from encouraged by the United Nations through the highly indebted poor countries initiative and so on is encouraging particular types of reforms in those African countries that receive the aid. So I don't think we're really seeing purely untied aid even today. It's more multilateral aid. China has slightly different ambitions, and so it doesn't seem completely unreasonable to me that they pursue those ambitions.
Can I just comment on that?
Well, I'd leave it right there. I'd like to open up, if we may. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd now take your questions from the floor. There are microphones that will be available. Can I remind you once again that this session is being both filmed and taped, so be aware of that as you make your question, and also speak up so that we can all hear. Can I take the first question from the floor? This gentleman right in the middle there. Thank you.
There's a regular of this university.
Thank you very much.
Of Iran is meeting with the leader of Russia and China to discuss what I believe might be some sort of new economic model for their part of the world. Of course, we don't know the outcome of this yet, but I address my problem to Saul. Does he see this as a possibility, remembering Russia is threatened to turn off the gas pipeline of energy to Europe. Mm. Iran is flexing its muscles still, and we don't quite know where China might go with this new alliance.
Good. Thank you very much. Saul, any comment on that?
Well, my impression was that the leaders of Iran had one or two other things on
their minds
on their
just
mind
at, the
at the moment. And what I think Mr. Last might be referring to was the meeting that occurred earlier this week in Yekaterinburg, which we remember as being the place where the Romanovs were killed by the communists, among other things, in 1918. But there was a meeting in Yekaterinburg of the presidents or leaders of China, Russia, Brazil and India to discuss potential changes to the international financial system. And China in particular, with the support of Russia, Brazil and India have had less to say about this because I guess they have less at stake, have expressed concern about the risks they face as a result of the large number of US dollars they hold in their foreign exchange reserves. China, as I mentioned, nearly $2 trillion US dollars worth, not all of it in dollars, but the bulk of it. And China with, I think at last account, Russia at last account with close to $500 billion, most of it in US dollars. Both of them are therefore at risk of some loss if the dollar were to fall. Both of them as having aspirations to displace the role of the United States as sort of orchestrator of what goes on in the international financial system, anxious to see the dollar knocked off its peg, because there are certain attractions and advantages that accrue to having your currency as the world's reserve currency. Among other things, you don't run currency risk when you trade because it's in your currency. You can borrow from the rest of the world and make your creditors take the currency risk rather than taking it on yourself as you normally do if you borrow in someone else's currency. And there are some other advantages as well that add up to what General de Gaulle famously called an exorbitant privilege. So I think what those countries are on about is exploring ways of, if you like, taking advantage of the current relative weakness of the United States to weaken the role of the US dollar in the international financial system. And while specifically the governor of the People's Bank of China has not proposed his own currency as a reserve, and the yuan does not at this stage meet most of the criteria required for a currency to be a reserve currency. Nonetheless, to position the SDR as an alternative. Now, as I say, in practice, I don't think that will work. But what they're doing is laying the basis for cooperation among themselves as rising powers in the international economic arena, with a view over the longer term to probably speeding the evolution of a world in which, just as there are multiple sources of economic and political power, so there will be more than one currency used in international commerce and finance. Mm.
Thank you very much, Saul. There's a question just there, the gentleman. Thank you. Oh, I beg your pardon. You're right in my line of sight, but I'll catch you.
Ken Burbridge.
Yeah.
China during both the Cultural Revolution and Tiananmen Square. A quarter of a century ago, the highest official ever outside of Beijing in Canberra was Jiao Ziyang. He made a statement that in respect to developing countries, they will not develop while the current financial order is held by the developed countries. My question is, how much will his pragmatic insight be revealed from his grave? In other words, how much will China make of changing the whole global financial situation?
Mark, would you like to have a go at that?
As I mentioned, the institutions that we have today were built in 1950 when Europe and the US were half of the global economy and 30% of the global population. And there's no doubt that that those numbers will be very much lower than that by 2050. To what role has the IMF played in the current financial crisis, in the Asian financial crisis, and in other sort of global crises in the past decade or so? I think it's debatable whether the IMF has been a culprit or not in these crises. In the Asian crisis, I think there's little doubt that the IMF solutions that were proposed in late 1997 and 1998 were the wrong solutions for the crisis. But remember, the Thai Central Bank rang the IMF up on July the 1st in the evening and said, "We're going to run out of money tomorrow. Can you give us a hand?" They didn't have a lot of time to think about how to solve this problem. So the initial policy response was the traditional policy response that they required them to tighten monetary policy, to tighten their budget and so on. I think they'd be, as the crisis became better understood, they were a lot more pragmatic in their approach. They encouraged lenders to roll over loans rather than to withdraw funds, which exacerbated the falls in the exchange rate. And I think it's not the case that they were on US banks or US mutual funds side or Western entities' sides on this one. They were very much trying to help out, I think, the Asian economies. They just got it wrong initially. In the current global financial crisis, there was a big debate about the nature of the global financial architecture and whether it needed to be changed. Mm. The problem is I don't think countries agree. There is not a Western and an Eastern or a Western and a developing country view particularly on this. I think China has a banking system, for example, that is regulated in a very different way to Australia, but the banking institutions in China are as stable as Australia's for different reasons. We have a lot more regulation, probably not as much as China, but we borrowed our regulatory system from Canada. It looks very different to the United States. The Europeans are different again. So the global financial architecture, I think, is very different from country to country. It's regulated in very different ways. And the role of the IMF as the sort of global overseer of this has, I think, probably been overstated in terms of their responsibility for, let's say, keeping poor countries down, as Jia Ziyang, I guess, was implying. Probably on the flip side, they're not as responsible or not as able to push the global economy along in the current environment.
Mm, thank you. There was one. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm Hans Steyer, an anthropologist in development studies, and I'm starting to feel like I'm a gadfly at this festival because I've asked so many questions.
Oh, that's good. Ask another one.
But at any rate, I'm not a China expert, but I have been to China, and what I saw in China over the course of 3 weeks struck me as an environmental disaster. And it almost seemed to me, as an anthropologist, that China was sort of picking up some of the worst mistakes of the West. And it seems to me that China has picked up on this idea of just ongoing economic growth, which basically is the premise of most economists. And I think it's perhaps time in a festival of ideas to think about other models, models in which we look at a world where we have greater social equality instead of increasing social equality, in which basically we have economies that are based on meeting social needs, meeting things like healthcare and education, and that we also consider what we're doing to the environment with ongoing economic expansion. Climate change is an obvious example of that, but there are many other forms of environmental degradation. So I think we need to think about an alternative global system. I don't say I have all the answers, although I've written about some of these things, that is environmentally sustainable. And I'm not really sure whether the system that has created the problem can solve the problem. Anyway, perhaps the panelists can comment on my rather broad observations.
Well, thank you very much. Let's start with a non-economist. Pradeep, how do you respond to that?
Well, I think, yes, I agree that China's economic growth story of the last 30 years has had serious environmental consequences. But having said that, I think China is also one developing country which is investing heavily in trying to deal with that problem. I mean, I'm not suggesting that China is likely to change its economic model. But at the same time, China is investing in trying to deal with some of the problems that have been created over the past 30 years. And when it comes to new technologies, I think earlier this morning's session, Antonia mentioned that China is now exporting solar technology to Australia. And there is a great deal of support to alternative technologies in China. The Chinese actually have a target, I think 20% of alternative technologies or renewable technologies. Now, I'm not sure whether that includes nuclear energy or not, but they talk about a 20% target of renewable energy. So also, I think, given the way the Chinese political system is structured, if the Chinese government takes initiative to deal with the environmental consequences of economic growth, it has the capacity, better than most other developing countries, to actually implement those policies. And I'm quite encouraged by the approach that the Chinese government is taking to dealing with environmental challenges. It doesn't mean that it's likely to change its economic model, so you'll be disappointed there. But where it can address those challenges, I think there is a great deal of initiative and interest in dealing with those.
Thank you, Pradeep. There's a question down the just here, gentlemen.
Just quickly on that one, interestingly, China is one of the few countries that has attempted to try to publish green GDP data. And economists have known for some time that GDP is problematic as a measure of welfare. For 150 years, we've known that. But the problem is finding something else as a measure of social welfare, which you were talking about. Green GDP has been one of many proposed alternatives to GDP. And China, the Philippines, a couple of other countries in our region have done quite a bit of work on producing that data. And I agree with Pradeep. I think I'm cautiously optimistic about China's approach in terms of dealing with environmental degradation.
Thanks, Mark. Sir?
Emeritus Professor Grichting. China has a reputation of utter disrespect for intellectual property and for poor funding of research and development. Remedying these problems might reduce the savings bubble. Mr. Eslake, perhaps you could help us out of how the international world might help China to meet its obligation with regard to intellectual property and research and development. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Saul.
My understanding of the way that Chinese respond to that issue when it's raised with them is to make the observation that when it had similar standards of national income, the United States was not notable for the way in which it respected intellectual property, and that as recently as 30 years ago, neither were the Swiss in particular. And right, yes, I thought
that's
you might
why
have
he
been.
Used the example. I think you're fine.
Have been. So, the Swiss were not noted for the way in which they respected intellectual property either. And I think this is an issue in some ways, as is the issue about
the expectations the rest of the world has of China, that they will, from where they are, sacrifice their aspirations to the same living standards that the West has, which they see standard. As making a disproportionate sacrifice or a double standard. So, you know, I think China is going to take the view that they're not going to be pushed around by what they regard, remember, they regard, as Western notions of intellectual property. And I think, you know, we think from our value set that that is wrong and unfair, but we're not in a strong position to insist that they do something differently, and they know that.
Yes,
so
won't stop us.
I think this is just something that we are going to have to work around, in the same way as if I can, you know, pick up something Mark said in his presentation. We, in our country and in most other Western countries, don't like the idea of state-owned enterprises operating in such a large segment of the economy and the kind of close political affiliations between the management of SOEs and the ruling party. I mean, even when state-owned enterprises have played a big role in Australia's economic development, as they have done in the past, there's not been the kind of fluidity between, for example, being chairman of the SEC and being a minister in the state government or something like that, as there is in China. And so we can take a view in Australia that, you know, while Chinese companies operate like that, we're going to impose certain restrictions on what they're allowed to do in Australia. But in the end, the Chinese are going to say, well, okay, if that's the view you want to take, we're just not going to invest here and we won't buy as much from you. And there's not much we can do to change their view about these sort of things. And, you know, I think that's the same view that, you know, I wish it were otherwise. But, you know, we are neither in a position to, nor do we really have the moral right to, tell the Chinese how they should organise themselves in that regard.
Mm. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you. One of the comparisons that are made between China and Vietnam, both of which are amusingly called market Leninist states and no longer Marxist-Leninist states, is that the Chinese have successfully divested themselves to a large degree of state-owned enterprises, SOEs, and also rid the military out of the economic sphere, whereas Vietnam has yet to tackle those two issues. Is that true or not true? I don't expect you to comment about Vietnam, but is it true in China?
Hmm. Pardee?
First of all, if you look at, you're saying that China has divested of state-owned companies. There actually hasn't been a great deal of privatization in China. You know, Chinese, all the major sectors of China's economy are still controlled by the state. They have corporatized them. They have, you know, they have created stock exchanges in Shanghai and Shenzhen, and many of these companies are now listed on those stock exchanges, but the state is still the biggest shareholder of most of these companies. Mm. So all the critical sectors are controlled by the Chinese government. As for the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, in the 1980s, if you look at why the PLA got into business, it was because in the 1980s, Deng Xiaoping was saying that we'll cut your budget because we need to focus in other areas. So in the 1980s, as the defense budget was being cut, the PLA were being forced to look into alternative means of generating revenue. But then, obviously, it led to a great deal of corruption. PLA became involved in all sorts of business activities, and it was competing with other state-owned enterprises. And that's when Jiang Zemin decided that there will be a deal with the PLA. PLA budget will be increased considerably, but at the same time, PLA would be forced to quit, you know, indulging in business activity. So now we've seen the PLA's official defense budget increase by 17 to 18% a year. But at the same time, PLA has been forced out of most of the businesses that they control. Yeah. As for Vietnam, I think, is in terms of policy innovation, Vietnam is still lagging far behind China. And there doesn't seem to be any great deal of desire to follow China in the model either. I'm not a Vietnam expert, so I don't really know, you know, what sort of internal party debates are going on within Vietnam. But clearly, they're not, you know, closely following the Chinese model.
Any comments from any other panelists on that particular?
Yeah, no, that's right. I think with the state-owned enterprises, I mean, they have tried to increase the circulation of shares that were to reduce government ownership and things like that, but they've been very unsuccessful so far. So the stock market is still relatively illiquid, relatively underdeveloped. So again, it's one of these problems that I think the government knows needs to be addressed, but at the moment, particularly with the financial crisis, it's not going to be addressed very quickly.
Mm. Well, just to that point, I wanted to ask this question myself before. Given, Pradeep, your point about the growing integration of the political and business elite, and now the point we've just been making about the government owning the SOEs and holding all the shares and so forth, to come to Saul's point about being able to take the retained earnings out of those companies and spend them, I mean, what's stopping the government doing that? It owns them. It owns them in a sort of grander political sense than just a narrow legal sense. Why can't this be instituted by the government without any major change?
Well, in the industry that Saul's most interested in the banking industry, yep. I mean, the structure is foreign banks, for example, can own up, foreign banks in total can own up to 25% of any one bank. No one foreign bank can own more than 20% of any bank. So you take the big banks and say 25% will be owned, and ANZ may pick up RBS's share of one of existing share of one of the big Chinese banks. He's not winking.
Is hopeful.
But that share won't change anytime soon. And the total amount of shares listed, the shares that aren't owned by foreign participants, is then very small. The rest is owned by a holding company, which is a government company.
But to Saul's point about getting savings out of the SOEs,
but these smaller shareholders do have board seats. There is some
so you're saying they can block it.
There is, well,
it's not only that.
Governance and transparency.
I think there are two other reasons as well. One is that in some cases the SOEs are themselves sources of political power,
right?
You know, that is the people who are bosses of steel companies, that they have political power themselves. I mean, if you want an Australian example, one that I know a bit about, the way in which the Hydroelectric Commission in Tasmania was in some ways more powerful than the Tasmanian government.
Really?
Not now, but...
Not that you're on the board.
But 25, 50 years ago. And in that sense, you would be saying, the government might be saying to a set of politically powerful people, we're going to take some money off you. Well, that doesn't happen quite as smoothly as you might imagine in a theoretician's policy prescription manual. The second thing is that it's not necessarily the case that the Chinese authorities themselves, the State Council and others, actually want to erect a sort of comprehensive social security net. In other words, there is a part of, the long-standing, predating the Communist Party, value set which says individuals saving a lot of their income and accepting responsibility for the care of their parents
and
their
healthcare,
all that sort of thing, an intrinsic part of the Chinese value system. And what I and other economists, I mean, I'm not by no means the original proponent of this, but what has been proposed as a way of neatly solving a number of problems is very much a Western suggestion, which is never going to be automatically accepted by the leadership of a country like China.
Sure, that makes sense.
I think there's another reason. Might be, if I can just
click
on that, is that in some sectors of the economy, which are dominated by state-owned companies, there is no full operation of market forces. Take oil and gas. Now, oil prices are controlled by the party, controlled by the government. And if you ask Chinese oil and gas companies, which were originally part of the Ministry of Petroleum, they are going to say, okay, if you're going to, if you want that, then obviously there has to be introduction of market forces. Allow us to set the market price of petrol.
Right. Yeah, I've got time for, I think, one last question. The gentleman in the middle.
Just wondering how evil private savings really are.
I don't know that evil's quite the word, but in respect of our capacity to adjust.
Could I ask the question at a... flesh that out a bit more.
Yeah.
Well, you're talking about the Chinese household saving too much money.
It's relative.
I mean, what I said there, and I was trying to address it specifically when I was up at the podium, is that although Chinese save by Asian as well as by Western standards a relatively large proportion of their disposable income,
like
40% or so, right?
Or more,
that household incomes themselves are a relatively small proportion of GDP, that is of total national income, again by Asian as well as by Western standards, and that the problem of overall excess saving, that is behind China's excessive current account surpluses, is actually not excessive household saving in the grand scheme of things, but excess saving in the corporate sector, predominantly, given the nature of the corporate sector, in Chinese SOEs. And I guess what I'm arguing, trying as I always do when talking about China, is to see the problem from the Chinese perspective, not from a Western or outsider's perspective, but from the Chinese perspective. The problems I see with that are that since SOEs are in turn responsible for a great deal of the investment within China, that investment is subject to no scrutiny or discipline other than the whims of the executives of the SOEs. Mm. They are not subject to any discipline that might be imposed by a bond market or a share market because they would have to raise capital from either of those. They are not subject to any discipline by a bank which might lend them the money as per the Japanese model traditionally. And finally, nor are they subject to any discipline from a Ministry of Finance or Ministry of Economic Development that might say, yes, you can have this money for investment because it suits the overall national economic plan. And I think, again, looking at it from a purely Chinese perspective, that the result of having no discipline of any sort at all over the allocation of much of the capital that is accumulated within the Chinese economy is a pattern of overinvestment in total, and within that overinvestment, investment in what is quite often not the right thing, including, if you like, to pick up the point that was made by one of the questioners earlier, including investment in things that actually add to the consumption of coal and add to environmental damage.
Yes.
Compared with the decisions that might be made if they were subject not necessarily to market disciplines through a bond market or a share market, but even to policy disciplines as applied through a Ministry of Economic Planning or something like that.
Mentioning banks and lending discipline in the same sentence, very brave of you, Saul, I'd have to say.
Well, that's why I say it posited some other alternatives.
A comment very briefly in wrapping up, Mark, either to that issue or anything else you'd like to say in closing?
Oh, I've only got a very long answer to that one.
A long answer to that. All right, we'll leave it at that
one off.
Pradeep.
No, unless there's a question.
No, I think that's fine. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for participating in this afternoon's session. Would you join me in thanking our three panellists,
Pradeep Kanaja, Saul Eslake, and Mark Crosby. Thank you once again for being a part of this afternoon's session. I trust, like me, that you've enjoyed it. Good afternoon.